Hey gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week on the podcast, I am back with Morgan Grigondretti. Last week, we talked about Roman era and ancient world game themes, and we led into talking about her game, Hubris, which is going to be the subject of this particular podcast. So if you're here for Hubris news and development action, this is your pod. How are you doing, Morgan?
Hey, Liz, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Well, I'm very happy to be here talking about Hubris. So you have a game coming out. It's called Hubris. What is the premise of this game for those who do not know?
Right. So as we touched upon last week, it's really about the Hellenistic period and actually the later period of the Hellenistic kingdoms. So Hubris itself will start in 220 BC and can go all the way up to 165 BC. So it covers really 55 years of history, which were very pivotal in that when the game begins, Rome essentially is a non-factor in the politics of the Eastern Mediterranean, which are dominated by three big kingdoms, which are the successors of Alexander and his generals. So we've got in Egypt, we've got the Ptolemies. In basically the Near East, Syria, Babylonia, and Asia Minor, we've got the Seleucids. And then in Greece, on Macedon, we've got, well, the Kingdom of Macedon. So the dynasty was the Antigonids. So that's the situation we have at the beginning of the game. And that's really a continuation of the situation which had prevailed for about a century. And then 50 years later, one of his kingdoms, Macedon, no longer exists. The Seleucids have been humbled and lost a big chunk of their territory. The Ptolemies have been reduced basically to a vassal state of Rome. So what happened in this time span to go from that situation to another? And this is what really drew me to this period, just like, in a sense, in my previous game, Pendragon, it was how you go from a situation where Britannia is a Roman diocese, so four provinces, to a situation where it's just a collection of rival warlords and petty kings, going at each other in a very barbarian way. So in both cases, this is one of what I call these hinge periods of history where something changes in a big way and changed the entire situation.
So who can you play as in Hubris? What are the factions at play?
Right. So that was one of the key design decisions which came at the very, very foundation of my work on Hubris. More than 7 years ago, he played one of the kings, one of the Hellenistic kings. Rome is a very big factor, obviously, but it's a non-player. It's an external threat or opportunity, depending on situation. But it is not a player, and it will never be a player. So you play either as, over 50 years, we've got a number of kings. I mean, you have two or three kings, depending on what dynasty we're talking about. At the outset of the game, in the regular game, there's an alternate scenario to start with, but you've got in Antioch, you've got King Antiochus III of the Seleucids. In Alexandria in Egypt, you've got Ptolemy IV. And in Pella in Macedon, you've got Philip V. So these are the starting kings, and so you're going to play them and then their successors, most probably, depending on what scenario you play, over these 55 years. And Rome is an external power.
So how do you win the game? What's the victory condition? What are these guys going for, given that inevitably things are going to fall apart.
Yes. So obviously, based on history, you might think that surviving as a viable power might be winning the game. but that's not a very motivating target. So actually, and that was, again, one of my objectives, is that I want the players to be thinking like their historical counterparts were thinking. Their historical counterparts, at least early, were not thinking in terms of, you know what, Rome is coming, I'm going to get crushed, I'm just going to try to survive. No. They were thinking in terms of, okay, what can I do to maintain or to build my personal position among the kings so that I am the prevalent king? So players will be, so there's a system of victory points, which is mostly based on territorial possessions, and then augmented by, you can gain victory points through other means like large building projects or winning fame on the battlefield, that sort of thing. But basically you total your victory points, and if you reach a certain threshold, you get an automatic victory. And then at the end of the scenario, well, there's really two ways to assess victory. One way is that whoever has the most victory points is the most powerful, so would be closer to being hegemonic. Hegemony being reaching that automatic victory point threshold. And then I have built a table where turn by turn, I have tracked the historical performance of the various kings and translated that into victory points. And so you can track your own performance against the historical performance, and you can assess your performance in terms of, you know, how much better or how much worse did you do compared to your historical performance. And then whoever has the best margin would win that particular scenario. But then this automatic threshold, which is set at 25 victory points, also has another meaning in the game, which is that it is such that, at least my assumption is that someone who would reach, if one of the kings had reached that level of hegemony, it would have been, or his kingdom would have been in a position to block Roman expansion.
Mm.
Reach that critical mass where they could have actually successfully opposed the encroachment of the Roman Republic. And of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, that's bollocks. due to this and that factor, there was no way Rome could have been stopped. And to be honest with you, I'm kind of agreeing with that position, but that doesn't make for a good game. And more importantly, that doesn't represent the understanding that the historical counterparts had at the time. They had to think it was possible to reach that critical mass and stop Rome. So what I'm trying to represent is their vision of the world. So yes, in the game, and you might argue that this might actually not be true in purely historic, on a pure historical basis, but if you reach 25 victory points, you have reached a point where you would have stopped Rome.
That's interesting as a victory condition. All right. So you mentioned that you have had Hubris in development in various stages for 7 years. It's actually your first game, if I recall correctly. So how has it evolved over all of that time?
It's not exactly my first game. I mean, I did work on other games before, but that's the first game that ever went to the table as a playable prototype. And that's an interesting thing is that, at least in my personal case, I found, but I think I'm not the only one, we all tend to have a lot of concepts, you know, going around in our head. It might be just from reading a couple of books and thinking, you know what, that would make for such a great game, and we could have this, and we would have these factions, and we would have this mechanism, and we build, you know, castles of thin air. We've got great ideas. We might even go to start working on a couple map concepts, jot down a few notes, whatever. But as long as it is not a complete prototype, that you can put on the table and start playing yourself, or bring some friends and have them play with you, or play between themselves and you observing. It's not a game. It's just an idea. And going from an idea to this prototype is a big step, which, you know, I've got a couple of cabinets which are full of notes on other games. And I don't know if I will ever turn back to these and try to make games from them. But Hubris, for some reason, was the first game where I started putting together a map and putting together even cards and putting together, you know, counters and printing them and start pushing things around. And this is where you get real feedback. Because, as I said, when you have built a castle of thin air in your head, it always works fine. You never see the little, you know, interfaces and, oh, I have this, but then when it interacts with this, it doesn't quite give me something which I think is right, etc. It's only by actually playing that you can see these things. And then you have to get other people involved, because then, you know, when it's only yourself, you tend to play as you intend the game to be played, but you're not going to stretch it. So it's only when you get other people to start playing that you can make progress. So yes, so Hubris was became a prototype somewhere, I think, like late spring of 2013, and at the time it was a fairly classical CDG, so card-driven game. Players would have, you know, hands of cards, hands of events, and a little bit like, you know, the Twilight Struggle or this kind of game. So you had adverse events and events of your side, and you would have to manage that and try to get ahead. And that game I developed for about a year, and it worked pretty well. I had the opportunity to show it to a GMT already back at the time. I was living in California. Had quite a few players test it, so made a lot of progress at the time, but then couldn't really get enough traction, I guess. And then I had the concept for Pendragon, and I don't know if we, I think we have told the story before, but basically Pendragon took up very, very quickly with Volker Wunke's support and stuff. And so I basically put a brief on the side while I was focusing on Pendragon for a few years. I would regularly go back to Hubris and revisit it a little bit. And then when Pendragon was done, I was very, very intent on going back and finish Hubris. And I remember having a conversation with Mark Simonich, who was like, hey, yeah, we're interested, we would like to have it. And I was like, oh, yeah, I got a couple ideas which I want to work in, but yes, in a couple months I should be ready for P500. That was in 2017. So, because the couple ideas basically snowballed, and there were quite a few things I wasn't actually... Well, I guess I was a much more experienced game designer after Pendragon, and having completed again, I mean, having gone all the way from concept through early prototype through going through the various stages of development and handling, a lot of external inputs and having all the great advice and support from Volko and his experience and getting through all this, exacting process of making it, you know, up to the actual files that you give to the art department and turn it into a game, and all the proofreading and all the, you know, so I had learned a tremendous amount of things, so it was bound that I would have a different approach to how I would do the game. But then there were some other things which I was not entirely happy with, and so I started working on it. And then I basically said, you know what, I'm going to start from scratch again. And then I had other things in my life, which took a lot of my energy and time for some time. So here we are now, 2020. The game is again, I think, getting very close to going on P500. I got a developer working with me, Kevin Bernat, who has a ton of experience, a lot of games, which has proved invaluable in, you know, that sort of thing. First thing is bringing someone else to look at the game and look at it in a different way. It can be frustrating at times because you're like, well, of course it means this. Is it not obvious? Well, not entirely. Okay. And so you've got to reword or you've got to clarify, or you've got to rephrase, etc. But and now we are doing playtesting on a grand scale. We have a Vassal module. We have players testing in Europe, all over the US, Canada. So we're getting a lot of input, a lot of good feedback. So yeah, we're making, I think, very, very good progress. And, you know, getting people playing the game in a way that I did not necessarily envision, which is important because, I guess to a large extent, I am a prisoner of my historical understanding of the period. So I will tend to play in a fairly historical way. Now you've got players who may, some of them, I got a particular one playtester in California who's actually Polish, who probably knows at least as much about the period as I do. And he's been having a lot of fun, but he's also been giving me a lot of feedback. So that's excellent. But I also have some players who know next to nothing about the period. So they will try stupid stuff from an historical perspective. But that's good because, you know, not everybody, we cannot expect everybody playing the game to be familiar with the period. And actually, I think one of the benefits of having these games is to touch audiences which were not familiar with this period and were going to discover it through that and hopefully desire to know, learn more about it, and, you know, see other games, see books and read them, etc. So you get behaviors where you're like, hey, why did you do this? Well, why not? Okay. Okay. And then you've got to rule, you know, okay, so you did that. The rules allowed you to do that. Is that okay? Does that seem like something which could have been done? If it is so, fine. If that's really something which for whatever reason was out of the realm of options at the time, then you have to make it so that it's not an option.
So what has come out of playtesting so far that surprised you the most in terms of the way that you intended Hubris versus the way it was interpreted by players?
I don't know. There's a couple of things which I had, which I used to have in the game, which I had taken out because I sort of wanted to give more flexibility or whatever, and which we are bringing back. I mean, I got feedback from players saying like, wow, D7 should be only for Macedon. And I was like, yeah, it used to be only for Macedon, don't you think so? I mean, there's a little bit of that. The biggest thing I think is my design intent with Hubris is that I saw the feedback from one playtester, which was like, oh, this game is supposed to be simple, but it's both simple and complex and deep. And I was like, yeah, I mean, the game is not meant to be simple. It's meant to be deep, but I like the rules to be fairly simple so that they are, you know, there's easy access to the game. So I tried to stick to a few key principles to be, you know, as consistent as possible across the various routines and mechanisms of the game. And then a lot of things to me, you know, with, I mean, I keep everything fairly simple. And then players will ask questions, and so they're pushing it. And so there's a big trend, a big push to put more into the rules, to say, you know, like, I tend to go with the philosophy of Volko and the Cohn series, where it's a very literal way of writing the rules. You know, we write what you can do. If it's not written, you can't do it. You know, it's something like that. And they're like, yeah, but nowhere does it say that you cannot do that. Well, yes, why would you do that? It's not. So there's a little bit of pushback around this. And sometimes you've got to clarify. And sometimes I'm like, you know, players tend to project. You know, nobody comes without baggage. You have played other games. You have other ideas. You may think that that's the way it should be. And so players, and we all do that, I think, tend to project this baggage onto the rules. And so they're like, oh, I played it that way because that's how I felt it should be played. Well, no, that's not how it should be played. Just do what the rules are telling you to do. And so it's not always easy. I mean, I'm trying to keep the rules as trim and, you know, short and intelligible as can be, not overload them with tons of, you know, there's nothing that annoys me more than, right, you know, you cannot do this. It should be, you know, or basically something to the extent that, you know what, you might think you might do this, but actually you can't. You know, that's it shouldn't be that way. But yes, I mean, I must say, I kind of observe a creep in terms of the length of the rules since we started this phase, just to make them a little bit less vulnerable to what we call, you know, rules lawyers. there's a ton of things which seems obvious to me, but obviously someone might, you know, take advantage of the fact that something is not completely spelled out to abuse the mechanism. So, yeah, there's a lot of pushing back and forth and trying to keep things as intended without making it too complicated. I think, as far as I can tell, in terms of the basic mechanics of the game, they remain very simple. We haven't added anything. We haven't, you know, anything significant. We may have modified a few things just to make it a little bit easier or sounder, but the basic mechanisms, I mean, Kevin will tell us, I mean, they are very sound. I mean, the game has already been played a lot. I mean, it works. But it was always played by me or with me around, so I could always sort of keep things, you know, in line. So we want to take the rules, take the game to a point where it can be played without me being within, you know, hundreds of miles of the gaming table. And so, yeah, it's a little concern of mine that we may end up having rules which, you know, at their core are very simple, but then still come out in a, I don't know, 30 pages or something, and people are like, oh, it's complicated. and I guarantee, no, it's not. I mean, I'm still thinking how I can make it clear that it's not, but at the same time, you know, you want to be able to play with just a couple player heads and what's on the map and what's on the cards, and then you only need to refer back to the rule set when something sticky pops up. Okay, that might be, you know, once or twice a game. Then you're going to turn to the rule book just to, you know, if players start having a disagreement how to interpret something, you can turn to the rule book. The rule book is going to give you the exactly what is meant. But we'll see. It's a real challenge. I know it's a big question nowadays. You know, how can we make games more accessible? the thing is that, and I'm not a big Euro gamer, that's kind of an understatement, but still, I understand that these games tend to be very focused on a few mechanisms, and so can really be very pure, I would say, in that. And so it's probably easier to make sure you don't have too many interference, too many stuff. Here we're trying to have a model, an historical simulation, which of course is abstracted in many ways, but you're still trying to represent situations which are inherently complex. You know, when you're dealing with a situation where, you know, even a city in a kingdom might be part of that kingdom, but also retain a large degree of autonomy in the way it handles a lot of things, including some international relationships. When you're trying to model, like I'm doing, the ambiguities of power and relationship within a king, you know, a king and his family and his entourage of friends and courtiers and advisors, there's a ton of ambiguity, and you cannot, you know, if you cut it all out, basically you lose the historical material. And so I think that intrinsically, especially if you're going for games like Hubris, where you have multiple dimensions, political, military, etc., there are so many interactions that they cannot be as streamlined as Euro games. And so to some extent, I don't think that you will ever be able to have games which provide that level of depth of simulation, that level of wealth in the portrayal of the period without a significant rules overhead. So now it is our job, well, not a job, but our responsibility to make it as easy and as accessible as can be. But I think that to a large extent, you know, when some go around and say, you know, if you are more than, I don't know, 10 pages of rules, nobody will, you know, none of the younger generation or whatever will ever play your game. Well, I'm sorry, but at least I'm not smart enough to provide that level of depth in 10 pages of rules.
So this actually leads me into my last question for you of this interview, which is, to what degree did you have to sacrifice historical accuracy to make Hubris a good game? And if you did have to do that, what was the hardest cut you had to make?
Well, probably the hardest part has been, and that's part of the reason why it has taken so many years to come to fruition, is that I had to reconcile very conflicting objectives. On the one hand, I wanted to have all these depths of, individual relationships, campaigns, the diplomacy and the interaction between, you know, minor players and the big kingdoms and Rome and all that. And that naturally sort of pushed for a granularity, which was fairly fine. At the same time, I wanted to represent, as I mentioned, this big shift from, you know, this purely Hellenistic world to this essentially Roman world. And that did not happen overnight. That happened over, you know, more or less 50 years. So I could not be too granular in my model, because then to represent these 50 years might have needed, I don't know, 20 hours, 30 hours of play, which is definitely something that very few people will ever allocate to such a game, at least nowadays. So I had to go back a couple times and just, you know, basically cut out stuff. I mean, and say, you know what? I used to have a very nice operational system. That system is essentially gone. I had to take an helicopter view and really keep only the main thrust on the main aspects of it, because there just wasn't any way to make it fit within a reasonable playing time frame. And when I say reasonable playing time frame, by my standards, a full game of Hubris, which is 11 turns, we've got 5 year turns, it's probably going to take you 6 or 7 hours, I would think. So many people are going to say, oh, that's way too long. I think that's pushing it. That's probably the more that you could, it's basically a full day of playing. And I think that's really the absolute limit. But then I'm offering a lot of scenarios which are shorter. I mean, so there will be, a number of scenarios which can be played in under 2 hours, I would say. So that's how I can played. But yes, I mean, it's really, you have to, as always say, I mean, the model is always, you try, what are you trying to focus on? And so it was very easy to get sort of drawn to providing a ton of details on the operational aspects. And it was fun. I mean, I remember some playtest sessions, including here in Montreal, our big annual convention. And I had players, we had played the whole afternoon and we had played probably something like 6 years of the game.
Oh, man.
So I was extreme. I mean, we had played 4 hours, maybe 6 years. So I was frustrated because I wanted the game to proceed faster. But the players were like, wow, that was so immersive. That was so rich. I could really feel that I had these agonizing decisions to make. And so they were happy. But that was not what I was trying to capture. Or at least that was not my primary focus. So a lot of that is gone. and obviously that's frustrating. So to the extent that I'm actually sort of keeping all of these feelings, I mean, I never throw away anything like this. So I keep that, and I'm like, you know what? Maybe someday I will do a game which is on a much scalar time scale and not focusing on this big epochal shift from Hellenistic to Roman, but focusing on that particular war or that particular campaign where we can go into the operational detail, to some extent, look at what Volko is doing with Nevsky and soon with Almoravid. These conflicts, between like the Teutons and the Rus', or between Muslim Spain and Christian Spain, these are fascinating conflicts which have lasted for tens, if not hundreds of years, right? Mm-hmm. You make a game like Pendragon or like Hubris focusing on, a large time span to try to capture these big shifts. Volko has taken a different approach. He's interested into the details of the logistics and how the feudal system would work for different cultures in order to undertake specific campaigns. So I think Nevsky covers like 2 or 3 years of history.
Right.
Almoravid is going to cover 2 years. So the grand strategic player in me is frustrated by this short time scale. Like, gosh, and you're only going to focus on these 2 years. I understand these 2 years were very interesting, but I mean, there's so much more out there that you're leaving out. And I'm sure Volko is frustrated as well. He knows there's a ton of stuff that he cannot even touch because his focus is different. So similar,
wow.
Because I wanted to have the big picture of these 55 years, I had to leave out a lot of the nitty-gritty operational detail because there was, again, I couldn't have both. I couldn't have the detail and the 50-year of scale, just like Volko could not have this level of detail and cover, 60, 100 years of history of conflict in Spain. So in both cases, it's a matter of understanding what you're trying to portray, what you're trying really to present to the players and be very, it's, as I said, it's it's painful, but you have to be, you know, at some point it just, yeah, it's not part of your scope.
Well, I personally am looking forward to the hubris of hubris. Thank you so much for coming on the pod to talk to me about it.
Well, thank you, Liz. And yeah, as I said, I mean, I picked that title a long time ago. I hope it will not prove prophetic.
I'm personally really looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I mean, I'm very confident that the game is going to be eating at long last P500 sometime this year. So, so yeah, I mean, we're getting close.
Again, thank you so much, Morgan, for coming on. Thank you, everybody else, for listening to us. And happy gaming, everybody.
Thank you.